You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
Someone who reads my column, Savage Love, in the Detroit Metro Times, brought a courtroom drama in Michigan to my attention over the weekend, and I am so grateful to you, Bill. A mom and a dad, conservative Christians, fundamentalists, have been ordered by a court to pay their son nearly $30,000 after they threw away their son's porn collection. First things first, most porn collections these days are stored online. If you even have a porn collection, it's most likely a bunch of links in your browser history that you forgot to delete. Not Michigan's Dave Working. He's the son in the story, and his porn stash filled a room in his parents' basement. And when his parents found it, when they found his more than 1,600 DVDs and 400 VHS tapes, along with two boxes of sex toys and a tambourine, which is not a sex toy, but as they say on the internet, anything's a dildo, if you're brave enough, so who can say where that tambourine has been? Anyway, after Dave Working's parents, Paul and Beth Working, found his porn in their basement, they trashed it. They got rid of it. They destroyed, that's his father's word, they destroyed the 14 moving boxes full of porn and sex toys they found in their basement and most likely an innocent tambourine. It took quite a while, Paul Working wrote his son in an email on the day the wicked deed was done, took quite a while to destroy all of it. But frankly, David, I did you a big favor by getting rid of all of this stuff for you. Dave Working sued his parents in federal court, and with his father's emailed admission to the crime having been entered into evidence, Dave Working won his lawsuit. The court ordered his fundamentalist Christian parents to pay him the full value of all that porn, which Dave Working himself estimated at $29,000. His parents insisted that that was too much money, and the court allowed them to hire an expert, a sexologist from the Erotic Heritage Museum in Las Vegas, to put a value on all that destroyed porn. And that expert that the parents hired at their own expense put the value of the porn at $31,000, which means mom and dad Working are out an additional $2,000 plus the fee they had to pay to the sexologist from the Erotic Heritage Museum in Las Vegas. The Erotic Heritage Museum is directly across the street from the Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas because, of course, it is. All right, back to the story. I was on Team Dave Working when I read the short summary that my reader, again, thank you, Bill, sent along to me. I mean, yeah, of course I was. My first impulse in a dispute between fundamentalist Christian parents and some horny kid is to take the horny kid's side. Mom and Dad, Paul and Beth, they tossed poor Dave's porn collection. What assholes! But after clicking through the summary and finding my way to Francis X. Donnelly's almost comically thorough reporting on this case in the Detroit News, I am no longer on Team Dave Working. I am now on Team Paul and Beth Working. I find myself in the strange and unfamiliar position of siding with fundamentalist Christian parents in a dispute with a horny kid. I'm not questioning the judgment the Ottawa County Sheriff who said what Paul and Beth did was a crime. I am not second-guessing the decision handed down by the Honorable Paul L. Maloney, a sitting justice of the United States District Court in the Western District of Michigan, who found for Dave Working. But Jesus Christ, do yourself a favor right now and look up Francis Donnelly's fully reported out piece on this case in the Detroit News and see if you don't come down on the side of the fundy Christian parents too. Dave Working isn't some teenager whose parents tossed his porn or some 23-year-old who had to move home during the pandemic. He's a 42-fucking-year-old adult, and he moved back in with his parents after his wife threw him out for refusing to even look for work to support his family, which he said to his wife he couldn't do because he's an artist. And even after not hearing a word from their son for 7 years, Dave Working's parents agreed to take him in, to let him move back home rent-free on just one condition: that he not bring porn into the house, which he did anyway. All right, I got to stop. There's no way I can do Francis Donnelly's piece in the Detroit News justice. I can't communicate everything that's so fascinating about the warring workings here without dedicating the entire show to the story, which has everything. Donnelly, who deserves a Pulitzer, has emails going back and forth between Dave Working and his parents, Paul and Beth, and his ex-wife going back years, going back to when Dave Working was in high school. There's a list of the titles of the missing porn movies, which are, of course, hilarious. And it turns out, and this is not so hilarious, that Dave Working may have owned the only copies in existence for some of these films, which means they're lost forever. And there's a mysterious safety deposit box, because of course there is, where Beth Working hid 44 of the, quote, worst of the worst movies she found in her son's porn collection in order to essentially blackmail her own son later. This is like a story by Charles Dickens, or a novel by Charles Dickens, a book step of a novel by Charles Dickens. The name of the protagonist is Dickensian David Working, spelled with an ER like jerking, a guy who refuses to get work. Hell, one of the missing films is titled Great Sexpectations. But reading this, it's a lot more like Bleak House with crates of porn and a greasy tambourine standing in for conflicting wills, and you're going to want to read this. And Hollywood, you're going to want to get on this. Jack Black and Danny McBride, if you guys listen to my podcast, or anybody who knows you guys listens to my podcast, get your managers on the phone immediately and buy the rights to Donnelly's story. Either of you guys could play the shit out of David Working. And Netflix documentaries? Get on this. It's not a murder. Well, not yet. Anything could happen. But Working versus Working could be the next Tiger King. And we're going to need a new Tiger King. With 41% of Republicans, motherfuckers, refusing to get vaccinated compared to just 4% of Democrats, and scientists telling us we won't reach herd immunity as a result of all this Republican refusal to get vaxxed, we're all going to need a new true crime documentary to lose our minds over once we're locked back in our houses 6 months from now. Joe Exotic got us through the pandemic spring of 2020. Dave Working could get us through the pandemic fall of 2021. All right, coming up on today's show, tons of your Q's, lots of my A's, and on the Magnum edition of the Savage Lovecast that you can subscribe to at savagelovecast.com, I speak with Dr. Alan Davis about his new study on mushrooms as a treatment for depression. Turns out shrooms may be a more effective treatment for depression than all those pills we're popping. That's on today's show. Me Undies makes feel-good underpants your butt will be proud to wear and you will be proud to be seen in. They will be the most comfortable pair of underwear you will ever own. And to check it out yourself, go to MeUndies.com/savage. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Talkspace, online therapy that makes it easy to get extra mental health support. For $100 off your first month, go to Talkspace.com and use the offer code SAVAGE. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Harry's, the makers of the best razors ever. New customers get a special offer and a Harry's starter set and body wash at harrys.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm an early 40s straight cis man who's polyamorous, and I have a slightly weird quarantine success story because it mostly revolves around not having sex. A year and a half ago, I was at a play party at a friend's house. I met this woman there that I was instantly attracted to and who seemed totally out of my league. But early on, I found myself sitting next to her. So I tried to chat her up and we wound up connecting on a bunch of things. But it started with the fact that we're both big fans of the Savage Lovecast. Anyways, it felt like there was mutual interest, but we didn't manage to reconnect at the party. Afterwards, we friended each other on social media, and I made clear that I'd be interested in dating, but she was a working single parent of two kids and polysaturated at the time. So it just wasn't in the cards. And instead, for over a year, we just maintained this occasionally flirty online chat friendship, connecting every month or few over this topic or that. But fast forward to December of this last year, over a year after we'd met, and she matched with me on a dating app and sent me a flirty message about having a sex dream about me. Something about it just stuck out as different, so I hit her up for a phone call, which wasn't our usual medium, and she enthusiastically accepted. What followed was a really intense, distanced dating experience. It ramped up within just a week or so to us talking on the phone basically every single night for an hour or two. Her existing relationships hadn't survived the pandemic, and neither had most of mine, so we were both home nearly every single night and basically binge dated each other by connecting through the phone calls every night. Along with distance hikes and backyard hangouts, plus lots of sexting and phone sex and Zoom sex. Long story short, we quickly fell in love, like really hard. We were two very slutty, very poly people who fell in love without having had sex. Hell, we hadn't even so much as hugged each other. And then fast forward to today, and thanks to vaccination, we've finally been able to share air regularly for the last few weeks. And let me say, getting to have sex after a really long flirty buildup is kind of mind-blowing, but we still talk on the phone nearly every single night for a solid 1 to 2 hours each time. Dan, this is the healthiest and most amazing relationship I've ever been in. It has the craziest origin story. We met at an orgy and didn't fuck, and then we started dating during a pandemic and couldn't touch, but we built the relationship on the back of a year-long flirty friendship, and we connect on so many different levels that it's crazy. So I just wanted to call and share the weirdness and wonderfulness of it all, particularly because technically you helped make it happen, since you were part of that very first conversation that we had. So thank you, Dan. You and the Tech Savvy at Risk Youth helped jumpstart a really amazing relationship. And to everyone else, go get your damn shot.
This may be one of my favorite success stories ever, not just because the Savage Lovecast and me and the Tech Savvy at Risk Youth and Nancy, never forget Nancy, played some small role in bringing you two together. But my God, you met at an orgy, didn't touch each other. Then you couldn't touch each other for a year, but you kept reaching out to each other and had a kind of Victorian long distance letter writing, phone call making courtship. It sounds wonderful. And I'm so glad that you guys found each other in the midst of all of this chaos and drama. Thank you for calling. Thank you for sharing your success story. Listeners, if you'd like me to begin next week's Savage Lovecast with your sex success story, give us a call, share. We might open next week's show with yours.
Hey, Dan, a woman here in her early 30s living in Washington. My sister has been in a long-term relationship with my brother-in-law for about 12 years now, mainly because of my sister's mental health issues and addiction issues. The relationship has been a roller coaster from the get-go. A few years ago, they legally married and had my little nephew, who's about 2 now. Right before COVID, his youngest brother, who he's really close with, moved in with them after a breakup. The short of it is, according to both of them, they're at a real low point. My sister is not making healthy steps to deal with her mental health issues, and they both work a lot of hours that are conflicting, so they don't see each other that much and are basically just co-parenting at this point. I guess when my brother-in-law told my sister that something needed to change or they'd have to separate, she suggested an open relationship and also suggested that she wanted to sleep with his live-in brother. Based on what they've both told me, it doesn't sound like they have any ground rules established. My brother-in-law went on a date with a coworker recently, I guess, and my sister felt super insecure about it and broke down for a week and was a wreck. But my sister is sleeping with his younger brother, like, in their own house. He is having a real hard time, apparently, with it, and it sounds like that house is really uncomfortable to be in right now, and I don't blame him. In the past, they've often shared a lot of information like this to me, and I've tried just to somehow listen to both of them and be there for them, try to be a neutral party, but this time I can't really help but feel a lot of judgment and anger towards my sister. The whole situation just seems so fucked up and is on the verge of imploding, with my nephew being the biggest casualty. So I don't know what I can do in this situation. I really want to help my nephew and make sure he grows up in a stable environment, and I just kind of feel helpless. Is there anything I can do, or I guess more importantly, what I shouldn't do?
Oh my God, what a mess. There's actually not a lot here that you can do if you're not willing to involve child protective services, instigate an investigation, possibly have that kid, your 2-year-old nephew, removed from your sister's home and offer to take that kid in yourself, for that kid to be placed with you, which you may not be in a position to do. But my God, if you are in a position to do that, you might want to consider it. It would be the quickest way to ensure that your nephew is growing up in a stable environment. That would be to provide him with a stable environment. Backing up, you talk about the brother like he's a potted plant. Your sister is sleeping with her brother-in-law. Well, her brother-in-law is fucking his brother's wife, his sister-in-law, your sister. What the fuck does he think he's doing? And why is your brother-in-law putting up with this? You say the brother moved in because of COVID. Well, he can move the fuck out because his presence is disruptive because of the drama. Obviously, your sister and her husband can't be in an open relationship. If she's going to have a meltdown if when he goes on a date, even as she is fucking his brother under the same roof with him and their two-year-old child, neither of them is healthy enough to be in an open relationship, and they need to close this relationship and remain, I guess, celibate for the time being. And you could encourage your sister to seek the mental health care that she so desperately needs, if not for her own sake, for the sake of her child. But the only stick you have to wield here is the threat of calling the authorities, of involving Child Protective Services. It doesn't have to go that far. You could say to your sister, so much drama, so much chaos in your house right now. Why don't you let my nephew, your son, come and stay with me? Come and live with me for a little bit. When I was a kid, my mom took in a nephew and two nieces. They lived with us for, I think, a couple of years while their parents were struggling with addiction issues, with mental health issues. And that was traumatic for those kids. It's traumatic to be taken away from your parents, even if your parents are in crisis, even if your parents can't take care of you. It is traumatic. And you have to weigh whether it would be more traumatic for your nephew to stay in this home. And to make that judgment, you need to make an honest assessment that you're not just reacting in a panic about the sex that your sister is having, that your nephew is probably at age two unaware of, and overreacting to that sex because it is so shocking that if your sister was going to choose another sex partner, she would choose her husband's sibling who happens to be living with them as the person she opened the relationship for. That's shocking, but it's not something that your nephew is probably consciously aware of. But you say there are mental health issues. You say there's chaos. You say there's drama. And it's not just the sex that I assume that you're referring to. So, yeah. Unless you're willing to offer to take that kid in and provide the stable environment, unless you're willing to involve CPS, in which case that kid could wind up in foster care if CPS doesn't select you or if you don't volunteer, all you can do in a circumstance like this is yell and scream and implore. And that's frustrating because we've all been there with some relatives where you yell and scream and implore and nothing changes and it gets no better. And when there are small kids involved, it does feel like a hostage situation. And when you can't do anything about it, when you can't rescue the hostage, that's a terrible feeling. And my heart goes out to you that you have to eat that potentially, that you have to watch all of this unfold, watch your nephew potentially be harmed, not by the sex necessarily or solely, but by the mental health issues, by the conflict, by the drama, by the chaos, by the instability, and not be in a position to swoop in and rescue your nephew. Man, that sucks. You can still be there for your nephew in other ways. If you can't take your nephew in full time, you can at least be a place where your nephew can go. You can be a refuge, a place where your nephew can go for three meals in a day, for overnights, for weekends, and you can provide your nephew with some stability. A mental image of stability. As he gets older, these things will become more important to him. A mental image of what a stable life might look like so that he knows that what he has at home, if your sister gets no better, isn't all that's out there or all he could have. It's a tough position to be in, the position you're in. I'm sorry. And you have my support, whatever you decide to do. Summer is coming. Is your underwear drawer ready? Which is just my way of asking, is your butt ready? MeUndies wants to make sure that this is your summer of comfort, and they want you to know that if you want to sit around in your underwear, that's absolutely allowed, and they can help you feel good, feel comfortable, and look great sitting around in your underpants. Get comfortable and express yourself this summer with undies in classic and bold colors and fun and adventurous prints. Terry and I both love getting that little package in the mail with delightful new underpants. We never know what pattern we're going to get, and sometimes they're downright hilarious. Baby Yoda on my boxer briefs? Yes, please. MeUndies is happy to help you find matching pairs or multiples in a style and color or print of undies that's right for you and your boo or all your boos. Because who doesn't love a secret twinning moment? MeUndies has a great offer for my listeners. For any new first-time customers, you get 15% off and free shipping. MeUndies also has their problem-free philosophy. If you're not satisfied with any product for any reason, they'll refund or exchange it. No caveats, no questions. To get your 15% off your first order and free shipping, go to MeUndies.com/savage. That's MeUndies.com/savage. Let them know the Lovecast sent you. MeUndies.com/savage.
Hey, Dan, Nancy, and the Tech Savvy Youth. I'm a cis straight woman in her late 20s living in the Pacific Northwest, and I have a question about sex toys. So I recently found out that I have chlamydia. And the other day, I was using one of my sex toys, a silicone-covered vibrator, and I washed it with soap and water, like always. And I'm wondering, is it safe for me to use it again? Is it possible that I could reinfect myself after treatment, or that I could infect a partner with chlamydia? Do I need to throw out the toy? I've never really heard anyone talk about this before, so just hoping that you could shed some light.
Sex toys, particularly insertable sex toys, should be washed after each use. And if your insertable sex toy is made out of glass or steel or medical-grade silicone, it is possible to clean that surface. Those are non-porous surfaces, so bacteria can't get into grooves or cracks or tiny little microscopic holes and then leap out at you later or potentially infect another partner. Your silicone-covered vibrator, if you washed it with soap and water, it is safe for reuse. If you're concerned, you can put a condom over it. You can also replace it with the kind of silicone vibrator where the vibrating piece of it can be removed, can be taken out of the silicone casing, and then you can toss the silicone, all silicone dildo, if it's a solid silicone dildo, or you can toss the sheath of a silicone vibrator when you can remove the vibrating attachment, toss that into the dishwasher, and it's going to get it super duper clean. It's going to heat it up and kill whatever might be on it. But just simple soap and water at the sink for a vibrator you can't throw into the dishwasher is going to clean it, if indeed it is made of silicone. The marketing of sex toys and the claims that are made by some sex toy manufacturers aren't subject to FDA approval, and there are unscrupulous actors out there in the sex toy industry. So buy from a reputable dealer, buy from a reputable, preferably woman-owned feminist sex toy shop. Make sure the toy that you're buying, if it's marked as solid silicone, is solid silicone. And then STI or no STI, coming down with an STI, getting that STI treated, it will be safe to use that dildo again. Even if you were unwittingly using it on yourself when you had chlamydia, it'll be safe to use that dildo again if it has been properly cleaned, if it is indeed made of silicone and preferably medical grade silicone between uses. And a quick final note about silicone. It's not a rubber. Silicone is made from silica or silica. It's from sand. So we make silicone dildos and vibrators from sand. Glass is made with sand. Concrete is made with sand. So when you look up and you see a glass and concrete building and you head home and you pull that silicone vibrator out of your drawer, same source material, same stuff went into producing all three of those things, all three of those necessities to human life. We all had an emotionally draining year in 2020. Hopefully there are positive things already happening for you and more on the horizon in 2021. It's a really good time right now to take what we all learned in 2020 about ourselves and start heading in a new direction. That's why instead of just celebrating a month of mental health awareness, it should be our priority to take care of our mental health all year long. Take the first step with online therapy. Talkspace is the number one online therapy platform that has thousands of licensed therapists trained in over 40 specialties, including anxiety, depression, relationships, and more. Working with your therapist can help you set and achieve your goals. I recommend therapy all the time on this show, and Talkspace is a great and convenient and safe way to get connected right now with a great therapist. Talkspace is a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy. Instead of waiting for an appointment, you can send unlimited messages to your therapist 24/7, and they'll engage with you daily, 5 days a week. Talkspace has thousands of licensed therapists with years of experience in over 40 specialties, including depression, anxiety, substance abuse, trauma, anger management, relationship issues, food and eating, and so much more. As a listener of this podcast, you will get $100 off your first month with Talkspace. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com. Make sure to use the code SAVAGE to get $100 off your first month and show your support for the Lovecast. That's Talkspace.com. Use the code SAVAGE. Take that step with online therapy at Talkspace.com.
Hi, Dan. I'm a sex-positive, single, queer mom of a non-binary, prepubescent penis haver in the Pacific Northwest. This afternoon, I went to check on my kiddo, who was supposed to be doing homework or schoolwork for the past 30 minutes or so. I knocked on the door and waited. They told me they were masturbating and covered up, so I came in the room. I chuckled at their honesty, and they showed me their shorts and underwear and a kind of proof that they were indeed touching themselves. I didn't ask for that proof, by the way. They then told me that they were masturbating for the past 30 minutes and that their penis had been hard for a while. And they were surprised that it went away when I showed up. So we are clearly close. Too close? Well, you're welcome to comment about that, but that's not actually why I'm calling. After my kiddo got dressed and washed their hands, they whispered to me, "I want a toy to make me feel good. So do I buy my 11-and-a-half-year-old prepubescent kid a cock ring? I think I've decided no, or at least not yet. I want them to explore their body without getting obsessed with some new thing or next toy. This kid already has an ethos that says buy, buy, buy. But I'm also curious to hear your thoughts."
Too close. My answer is too close. My comment is too close. You are too close. You know, mom, there's sex positive and then there's no boundaries. There's sex positive and then there's no respect for someone's privacy. Boundaries are important for sex positivity. Somebody who doesn't know what boundaries are, someone who arrives at puberty and arrives at their first relationships without any concept of boundaries is very likely to violate other people's boundaries. And that doesn't contribute to a culture of sex positivity. That contributes to a culture of sexual violation. It also sets your kid up for failure emotionally, socially, sexually. Don't do that. When you knocked on your kid's door and they said they were masturbating, that was your cue not to walk into the room and verify the fact that they were masturbating or to put them in a position where they felt that that was information that you wanted them to share with you. That was your cue to go the fuck away and come back later. Sex positive parents, well, those who are confused about the concept at least, will sometimes think you can't establish boundaries without imparting shame. But a respect for a kid's privacy isn't shaming, it's affirming. Communicating to a kid that mom understands that J-O time is alone time doesn't create shame. It shows respect. It's fine to have a relationship with a queer sex-positive parent or a straight sex-positive parent where you feel that you can talk to them. You can talk to them about pleasure and self-pleasure and masturbation and sex toys and relationships and anything else. But, you know, there's a time and a place to have those conversations with your mom. And when your dick is in your hand is not the time. And in your bedroom, when your dick is in your hand is not the place to have that conversation with your mom or for your mom to attempt to initiate that conversation with you, which is what I suspect consciously or subconsciously was going on. You walked into that room to have that conversation with your kid at a moment that you should not have had that conversation with your kid. My answer to your other question, do you buy an 11-and-a-half-year-old penis haver kid a cock ring? My answer there would be, in this instance, no. A kid, a penis haver, they can make a cock ring out of a scrunchie. They can make a cock ring out of a shoelace. I did it then. If they want a cock ring so badly, they can do it now. I am not opposed to parents obtaining sex toys for kids. I've talked about this on the show in the past. A penis haver or a boy can make an insertable sex toy for themselves by just making a fist, and suddenly they have something they can insert their dick into. Somebody with a vagina, a girl in most cases, who wants to experience or play with penetration, wants a penetrative toy, doesn't have that option. And you don't want your daughters using things as penetrative toys that are not safe to use. So in some instances, when we're talking about 15, 16, 17-year-old girls, I have recommended to parents that they help them obtain a sex toy if the kid wants one, or if they've discovered the kid using things as insertable sex toys for experimentation or play or self-pleasure that are dangerous. But just your kid wanting a cock ring? No, no. You have got to start role modeling healthy boundaries for your kid. And one way for you to model healthy boundaries is to not get them a cock ring. No, mom. And of course, the most important way for you to start modeling healthy boundaries for your kid is to establish some. They're almost in puberty. If they're sitting at a computer at age 11, 11 and a half, they know what cock rings are. They're in it. They're probably hurtling into the very first stages of puberty. Once your kid is there, that closed door, you knock. There's nothing bad about masturbation. If it's an inconvenient time, if your kid is otherwise occupied, you don't walk the fuck in the room chuckling. You stay the fuck away and wait for your kid to come out of the room and wash their hands. And then, if they so wish, initiate a conversation with you about whatever issue they might be having. Mom, too close. Don't set your kid up for failure in the future with their peers, with their future sex partners. Don't, by failing to demonstrate healthy boundaries with your kid, put them in a position where they might, with no malicious intent, violate someone else's boundaries going forward because they can't perceive them. Mom, it's boundary time. This episode of the Savage Lovecast is brought to you by Harry's. You shouldn't have to choose between a great shave and a fair price, and with Harry's, you don't have to. Personally, I am not interested in having a bunch of plastic, bright yellow, cheap-ass razors floating around my bathroom, ending up in the garbage after using them once or twice, and then ending up in a landfill or the ocean. I like to have a nice, well-made object, especially if I'm going to be doing something as intimate as shaving my face or anything else with it again and again and again. Harry's, they deliver a close, comfortable shave at a fair price, still as low as $2 per refill. Harry's is a young brand, but they've embraced centuries of blade-making tradition. They bought a German razor blade factory that has been making blades for over 100 years. Their craftsmen grind strong steel into a Gothic arch shape, creating a blade that is strong at the base and sharp at the tip. Their design team combined a weighted ergonomic handle with a textured grip and a flex hinge. It's a smart, simple razor designed for delivering a close shave along all the contours of your face. And despite its high quality, the price is reasonable, again, as low as $2 per refill. Harry stands behind the quality of their blades so much that they have a 100% money-back guarantee at harrys.com. And for a limited time, Harry's has made their exclusive offer even better for listeners of the Savage Lovecast. New customers get a special offer and a Harry's starter set and body wash at harrys.com/savage. That's harrys.com/savage. You'll get a 5-blade razor, weighted Truman handle, foaming shave gel, a travel blade cover, and a travel size body wash. There's never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/savage to redeem your offer today. Let them know the Lovecast sent you, harrys.com/savage.
Hey, Dan, Nancy, and the Tech Savvy at-risk youth. I'm a 30-year-old cis bisexual Latino man, and I'm calling today to ask if there's a difference between Asian fetishization and finding Asian features attractive. But I've been seeing this Vietnamese woman, and after we had sex the other night, she jokingly asked me if I had an Asian fetish. Before I even answered, she started laughing and saying she likes to mess with guys by asking that. I knew her from high school, so she knew that I went to school with a lot of Vietnamese people, so I simply said I know and grew up with way too many Viet people to have any preconceived notions about them. She then went on to talk about how she kind of fetishized Latino men for being passionate in the past, but was working on that, and that wasn't why she was with me. We'll see on that. See about that, I suppose, but I am passionate, so it might not matter. At any rate, her honesty struck with me, and now I'm wondering something. I don't think of Asian women as submissive or whatever else. In fact, probably the opposite. So many of the Viet women I know are intelligent, outspoken, and passionate. I do, however, find Asian physical features to be attractive. The jet black hair, beautiful eyes, great skin tone. Her honesty made me start questioning my own preferences. I've actually never dated an Asian person before. Man or woman, they've all been white or Latino. I guess I'm asking, does appreciating the specifics of a race equate to fetishizing them?
I don't think being able to appreciate the beauty of Asian features or African features or Latino or Hispanic or indigenous features is in and of itself racist. There is a difference between fetishizing someone because of their race, fetishizing someone, Asian fetishization, and finding Asian features attractive. I was digging around a little bit. I was reading some articles and I found one online, Sexual Racism, Intimacy as a Matter of Justice at the University of Chicago Press by Sonu Bedi. And they define sexual racism as prioritizing individuals as romantic partners in a way that reinforces ideas of racial hierarchy or stereotypes. That's sexual racism. I would say that expecting someone to conform to cultural stereotypes or perform them for you, that is racist fetishization. You weren't doing any of that. You're attracted to this woman. You're attracted to her in part because of how she looks. She has Asian features. You found her Asian features attractive. You can identify what's unique to many Asians about Asian features, the black hair, the facial features, and you find that attractive. You don't find that attractive because Asian women are submissive. You don't find that attractive because you think it's exotic. You have been around Asian women all your life. You're not exotifying the woman that you were dating or all Asian women. And so, yeah, you're self-conscious of, and that's good. We should all be a little self-conscious where race is concerned. We should examine our motives. We should scrutinize our behaviors and our choices, including our erotic ones. And that's to the good. But based on what you describe and how you feel, I don't think you're guilty of an act of sexual racism here or racist fetishization. You know, Stephen Colbert's character on Comedy Central back when he played a right-wing blowhard would say this thing, and it gave him away as kind of a racist, a thoughtlessly racist right-wing blowhard. Not that there's anything okay about thoughtless racism as opposed to malicious racism. Both are malignant and do damage. But he would say this thing, I don't see color. That is a cliche. So many white people have said that. So many white people who don't want to confront their own racism or don't want to acknowledge systemic racism will say that, so much so that it's a cliche. It's a racist cliche. Color exists. It's visible. It's important. It's impactful. Color matters. We all see color. Our erotic imaginations also see color too. We're supposed to pretend, I guess, that they don't see color or that preferences that are obviously shaped or limited by prevailing beauty standards, which can be racist and are straight up racist. And a lot of us just accept and internalize these racist beauty standards. And we tell people that people have internalized racist beauty standards, can only see European features as beautiful, that they have to unlearn that particular kind of sexual racism. Other people's erotic imaginations react to those beauty standards by rebelling, by rejecting them, by transgressing against them. And we tell those people that if their desires tip over into expecting someone of a different race to inhabit a stereotype, or our desire for them reinforces a racial hierarchy because we expect them to be submissive or play a certain role that taps into racist stereotypes, we tell those people they're guilty of fetishization in a potentially damaging way. But I think we can all spot the difference between someone saying, and forgive me for saying this, and I apologize, but people used to say this, between someone saying, I have yellow fever, or some gay guy saying, I'm a rice queen, which is a horrible thing that some gay men who are attracted to Asian guys used to say. There's a difference between saying shitty things like that and saying, I think Asian features are attractive. I find Asian people attractive. A kind of perfect erotic indifference, a perfect erotic racial ambivalence is impossible. There are certain kinds of features that people are drawn to. And there's generally not a lot of interrogating of these kinds of desires when people are drawn to people who are like them or to people who mirror the prevailing Eurocentric beauty standard in the West. And there should be. We should all interrogate our desires. I think the deeper question is, what do you do when you do have fantasies that tap into racial stereotypes? Well, there are people out there who have those kinds of fantasies. But there are people on both sides of that divide who have those kinds of fantasies. These stereotypes are powerful, and they loom large in the culture, and they're erotically charged. And it's not just white people that tap into those kinds of stereotypes. When white people thoughtlessly enforce them or expect that people of color will not just play at these stereotypes consensually in an erotic encounter, but are these stereotypes, that is damaging. But it is also true that sometimes people from marginalized groups, racial or otherwise, get off on stepping into stereotypical roles. Having the power to enter and exit them in a way destabilizes them. By entering and exiting them by choice proves that they're stereotypes, that they're social constructs, racist fictions that can be powerfully arousing. And if contained, if compartmentalized with tall firewalls, tall and thick firewalls built around them so that everybody engaging in that kind of play consensually is neither reinforcing these damaging racist stereotypes or harmed by them, I want to say then it's okay, but people aren't waiting around for my permission to engage in this kind of play. When it's play and consensual and thoughtful and interrogated, I think it's, again, I don't want to say allowed. People are going to do it whether I allow it or not. I think it can be a form of healthy sexual expression, again, so long as it's consensual. But that's we've come a long way from your question. Is there a difference between Asian fetishization and finding Asian features attractive? Absolutely. And you are evidence of that distinction. You are evidence of that difference.
Hi, Dan. I am a 22-year-old female calling from the West Coast. I've been sleeping with my ex for over a year. We text every day. We see each other like once a week and hook up. And it's really just all about him when we hook up. Like, I go over there, we talk for a few minutes, we hook up. I like don't get foreplay. And then I leave. There's a lot of other problems. It's not just the sex, but there's a lot of other things. And I'm like, I know this, I just need to end this relationship. It's just so hard because I love him so much as a person. It's just hard to end things. So he just recently stopped talking to me for 2 weeks. And in that 2 weeks, I started selling my content to a sugar daddy. And he sent me a letter. My ex-boyfriend sent me a letter. And we started talking again. And we're going to talk in person to resolve our issues. And I'm just wondering if this is something I need to tell him about me selling my content. Because it's like we're not even dating. But I feel like I do owe him that disclosure. But at the same time, I feel like I don't owe him that because we're not dating. And he was not talking to me for 2 weeks. And I also want to keep selling my content because I got a lot of money and I need that money right now. So I'm just wondering what you think I should do. I know, Dan, if you knew the whole situation, you would tell me to dump the motherfucker already, but it's so hard to dump the motherfucker when I love him. What do I do, Dan?
I want to tell you, of course, to end this relationship, that's what you need to do. You obviously know you need to do that, but there's no relationship here to end. Dude's your ex. You've been fucking your ex, or your ex has been fucking you. You've been showing up at his apartment over the last year to have, so he can basically jack off inside you. He provides you with no foreplay. I can't imagine if he's providing you with no foreplay that you're getting anything out of this, that you're coming from these encounters. So basically you've been his fleshlight for a year. He's been using you. And over the last 2 weeks, when he stopped talking to you and you began to sell your content for a lot of money, money that you need, obviously the choice is to keep selling the content for the money that you need. And you don't answer to your ex. Maybe you can get together with him and have some quote unquote closure, talk about the end of this relationship. If you want to see how he reacts, disclose the fact that you've been selling content for money that you need, but can you trust him? You don't tell me anything about it. You say you love him. I love him. You love him, but you don't give us any details. Is he an asshole? Do you think he'd retaliate against you? Do you think he'd be shocked? Do you think he would slut shame you if he knew that you were doing this thing that you're doing, that you've enjoyed doing, that you've benefited from doing, that you don't feel any shame about doing? Would he not want to see you anymore? If that's the case, if knowing that you've been selling your content, whatever your content might be, to a sugar daddy would so turn this guy off or make him so angry that he never wanted to see you again, I would urge you to disclose that fact to your ex. So your ex can be your XX. I guess an XX is a current. So your ex could be your XXX. Yeah. End this relationship by any means necessary. Just stop talking to him. Tell him it's over, if that's the best way to end it. If telling him that you've been selling your content to a sugar daddy is a more effective way to end it, if he's not going to want anything to do with you ever again after learning that, by all means, disclose the fact that you have been doing sex work over the last couple of weeks that you haven't been hearing from him. And one way or another, hopefully, you'll never hear from him again. All right, before we get to this week's listener response calls, let's read some listener tweets. Cyborg Space Cat tweeted, "Listening to Dan Savage on the Savage Lovecast this week, fielding a feeder call, and I couldn't help but think an opportunity was missed several times to say, you can have your kink and eat it too." All right, I didn't say it, Cyborg Space Cat, but Stephen Forrest, an alert listener, he said it for me. Stephen tweets, "Regarding the feeder gainer kink call, Dan, when you said you can have your kink, I said, and eat it too out loud." Thank you, Stephen, for picking up the slack. Alex Wish tweeted, "As I was listening to the Savage Lovecast today, I looked at my butt plug and almost said, get ready because you are going into the refrigerator today." And finally, Villain at Villain Report tweets, "At Fake Dan Savage, you are a pervert and you are encouraging other people to ruin their lives in perversion." Calm down, Villain. There are lots of ways to ruin your life, but enjoying kinks safely and sanely with other consenting adults, which is what I advocate, that's not one of them. People who drink too much, they destroy their lives and their livers. People who get tied up too much or wear too much rubber gear, refrigerate their butt plugs too often, they are not destroying anything except the occasional hole. And then only temporarily, holes bounce back, livers don't. Okay, thanks to everyone who posted to their social media accounts about the show last week, even you, Villain. And if you want to make sure that I see and possibly read your tweet on next week's show, be sure to use the hashtag SavageLovecast. And now your response calls.
"Hi, Dan. I couldn't stop thinking about the woman who was describing her husband and his interest in anal sex. My advice to her is to buy herself a big old strap-on, and every time he wants to have anal sex, to fuck him in the ass instead. I think every guy who penetrates should be penetrated so that he has some sense of what it feels like, when he might be in the mood for it, and how to warm someone up before he does so."
This is for the woman with the kinky partner. "Dan was too nice about this. You need to dump his big pigged ass. This doesn't sound like a relationship. This sounds like he's a narcissist sex addict who is manipulating you. You shouldn't be fighting about how you're not GGG enough. You don't need to prove your love to him through sex. If he needs it so bad, he can find a sex worker instead of constantly guilt tripping you."
"Hey, Dan, I have some ideas for your back-to-back callers on episode 759 who were trying to reasonably incorporate some extreme fetishes in their relationships. For the woman exhausted by her male partner's indefatigable appetite for extreme anal play, he needs to buy a fuck machine. Look them up. There are lots of them. But this way, he can experience extreme penetration whenever and however he wants it. And for the gay guy conflicted over his appetite for obesity play, buy a fat suit. Thanks, Dan, for all you do to bring integrity to relationships of every shape and size."
A sad note before we end this week's show. Mistress Velvet, a proud black femme professional dominatrix, a sex workers' rights advocate, and a recent guest on the Savage Lovecast, died unexpectedly earlier this month. I was lucky enough to get to talk with Mistress Velvet about her unique and really radical approach to professional domination. She commanded her mostly white male clients to read the works of Audre Lorde and other black feminists. We talked on episode 719 of the Savage Lovecast. I really enjoyed speaking with Mistress Velvet. I was hoping we'd get to meet up in person after the pandemic ended, and I was just so, so sorry to learn of her death. My condolences go out, my heart goes out to Mistress Velvet's family, to her friends, and to her many communities. All right, we're going to leave it there. Got a question for me or a comment about this week's show? You can call us at 206-302-2064 and leave a voicemail, or you can use the Voice Memo app on your phone to record your question or comment and email it to us at voicemail@savagelovecast.com. Magnum subscribers, Magnum subs, mark your calendars. Our next SAC Lunch is Thursday, June 3rd at noon Pacific time. SAC Lunch is our new monthly virtual hangout for Magnum Savage Lovecast subscribers. If you aren't already a Magnum subscriber and want to enjoy ad-free shows with more questions, more answers, more guests, and be able to join us every month for SAC Lunch, go to savagelovecast.com to become a Magnum subscriber today. And while you're on the internet, head over to humpfilmfest.com to get your tickets for Hump's Greatest Hits Volume 3. You've only got a few more chances to catch these 20 sexy, kinky, dirty, funny short films. We got your sexy centaurs, your buttered toast, your musical comedy about piss play. This Hump has got it all. Go to humpfilmfest.com to get tickets now. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian. And me and the tech savvy at Risk Youth and Nancy will all be back at you next week with another installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thank you so much for downloading.